The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's November 6, 2024, and it's 2:32 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thanks for finding us. Share us with your friends. This is the podcast that cares about Chicago and the world. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin. I draw on decades of experience as a journalist, a government reform worker, communications consultant, activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, and now writing the Chicago History website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, the former Tribune columnist, now publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly newsletter on Substack.
I started my WGN radio show today this way. I spoke at some length. I won't read it all, but I wanted to share with you a couple of my opening paragraphs. So how was your night last night? When did you go to bed? Here in Illinois, 53% of you probably did not sleep well. 45% may have stayed up late. The race was called by our sister network, News Nation. Its Decision Desk HQ called it first, in fact, at 12:22 this morning. The other networks declared Trump the winner later on. So perhaps if you were pulling for Harris, you hope to wake up to some surprise that Wisconsin held, that Pennsylvania prevailed, or that the House flipped. You glanced with one eye at your phone, and when you turned on the radio, you hoped to hear our Bob Surratt or Steve Grzanich, with their words or even tone, give you some cause to believe that what happened did not happen. I suspect that those of you who pulled for the new president-elect felt validated, happy but validated. See, I told you so, you may be saying. I wonder if you also have a little be careful what you ask for going through your mind today. But today, your texts and pages and friends are so much different than the majority of this state and the vast majority of the city, where Trump took 22%, but did surprisingly well in seven wards where he took over 40%. Chicago's Rex Hubke, writing in the USA Today, said he no longer wants to hear the line, America is better than this. This is what America wants. Forget about the antiquated Electoral College. Kamala Harris lost the popular vote by 5 million. So more people today are happy than sad. They voted wide-eyed for an election-denying, twice-impeached felon who says he wants to be a dictator. Forget about migrants eating pets. The big picture was there, and we chose that, which says, I think, a lot less about his opponent than it does about those who never felt like our leaders heard them. And so they pushed that button, even if it was not in their best interest. Marge, I was thinking about you a lot last night because you worked so hard on recruiting voters in Wisconsin, and you put out a post which shared how you were able to court a woman, convince her, and then go back on election day, and she felt so empowered, like, hey, I'm an American and I'm participating in the system. It would have been a shame to see her on the sidelines, period, and you also persuaded her to your side. Your side didn't prevail, but I just thought it was a reminder of how sometimes elections are hard fought on the streets, and I was touched by your efforts, I must say.
Thank you. It was a touching experience, and when I train canvassers, I tell them that. You know, you don't get to talk to most people. You talk to 25% maybe of the doors you knock, and conversations are 2 or 3 minutes. But when you make an honest connection like this, it's really, really moving. And this young woman had, she had a 10-month-old. She's pregnant again. And she said, that way, I have a 10-month-old, I'm pregnant, and I'm broke. She has religious beliefs that, although she's had an abortion before, that make her feel she would not do it again. But she thinks women should have the choice. But she didn't think her vote mattered. She'd never voted before. She didn't see why she should vote now. We talked. We were there a long time, me and my campaign buddy. We talked a lot about a lot of different issues. She's been listening to Candace Owen on TV, and she said, they're saying that Harris would allow doctors to kill babies after they're born as post-birth abortion. Is that true? Like, no, that's not true. That's homicide. It's illegal. She's like, I knew it. And then she ran through these other things, these canards that she'd seen on the ads. And as we would show her that her gut feeling was reliable, she became more and more confident. And in the end, we said, don't you want to tell your daughter you voted for the first woman president? And that's locked it down. And she was all ready. We did come back to give her a ride, but she wasn't home. And as we pulled out, she pulled up. Her grandmother had given her a ride, and she was just delighted to see us. She's waving her hands wildly at us, and she's wearing her I Just Voted sticker, and she was so proud to participate. I can't contact her now. I didn't get a phone number. But I don't know what she would have to say now. But there were a lot of those conversations. And I think we can't talk to every voter who has watched those TV ads and doesn't know what to believe. We can't talk to every voter who thinks their vote doesn't count. One thing we said over and over in Michigan is Hillary Clinton lost Michigan by 3 votes per precinct. So those people who think their vote didn't matter really paid attention to that. We turned out, I don't know, hundreds of votes that wouldn't have come out, but it was woefully short.
Mm.
I don't know entirely what to make of it. These low information voters are real. A young black woman who was concerned about the immigration and said to me, well, Trump says they're sending criminals over. Is that what they're doing, emptying their mental institutions? No. You know, I think about it. Who packs up their household, their children, walks for 2,000 miles, comes here in order to shoot somebody? Like, that's not why they come here. They come for the same reason my family came here.
But Marge, I just positioned this as not low information voters. I understand what you're saying, but I think the vast majority of the people voting for Trump understood what he was. And those votes weren't predicated on lies. They knew that he was a convicted felon. They knew he was twice impeached. They knew he led an insurrection. They knew he lies, and they still voted for him.
Some did. Some did not.
Yeah. Let me ask the panel, what was the big surprise to you last night? Austin, you go first. What jumps to your mind when I say, what surprised you last night?
There's a lot of surprises. One, just going off of what Marge was talking about, is the fact that we saw this ticket splitting in Michigan and Wisconsin. So the people who did a lot of work there to try to get Kamala Harris elected president shouldn't think that that was in vain, because the political ramifications of having those two Senate seats as Democrats is pretty extraordinary. When you have Baldwin and Slotkin winning those races. So that was a surprise. I think just looking here at our home in Illinois, Trump winning 22% of the city, mm-hmm. that is higher than Bruce Rauner won Chicago when he won the governor's race in 2014.
Well put.
and seeing that was really driven, as you saw in places around the country, It's unclear if this realignment is here to stay, but it is a realignment at the margin among Hispanics and Black voters who did not feel as though they could cast a vote for the Democrat for president. I would those round out some of my bigger surprises, I think.
I was pretty shocked that it wasn't close. That was really, I did not know who was going to win going into it, although, as you know, I had a bad gut feeling about Trump, but I was certainly convinced that it was going to be down to the wire. And I really did not think that we all today would be able to discuss a definitive vignette.
Yeah, me too.
So it's really something that the Democrats even lost by the popular vote. I think it's something that I really, really hope is going to cause some real introspection after the rage and grief period.
Well, I want to second what Kay just said, that this if these numbers hold, and I think they're, but there was approximately a 12 million vote swing. Joe Biden won by 7 million votes in the popular vote. And right now, I think Biden is up, or sorry, Trump is up by 5 million. So it's a huge swing in votes. I also noticed, some people on the left are like wondering if there's fraud because of this. But if you watch the coverage about when they would drill down to individual counties all over the country, you would see that Trump was outperforming himself in 2020, certainly, and sometimes even in 2016 when he won, that he made these incremental gains in all these places. So there's no fraud in this election. The Democrats got clobbered. And I guess the thing that did surprise me is that, or is an NBC News exit poll, the Hispanic voters went 45% for Trump versus in 2020, only 32% of them went for Trump. That's an enormous swing. I don't think the change was quite as big at all among Black voters, but that is a problem. And I think that when you look at the scope of this, and landslide is probably the right word to use by this. It's certainly a mandate. When you look at the Senate, losing, the Democrats lost the Senate, and it looks right now they're probably going to lose the House again as well. But the voters are telling the Democratic Party something that the Democratic Party hasn't been listening to.
What?
I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I think that it has to do with immigration policy. And they're angry about the economy. The economy is in pretty good shape, actually, right now. It's the envy of the world, as a lot of people have said, that our recovery from the pandemic. But immigration is an issue
the Democrats would have passed the bill. Kamala would have signed it. Joe Biden would have signed it. They would have had the most restrictive border policy we've ever had. It would have been as big a revamp of that whole immigration issue as we've ever had.
And they,
Democrats were behind that.
That's true, but they waited, 3.5 years to do that? I hear what you're saying, John, but I think that there's some issues here, and some of them has to do with this with identity politics that are being emphasized by Democratic candidates and voters. And certainly the hard progressive left. And a lot of those issues, I agree with them on, but I think that they're not speaking to voters. And you can agree all you want with some of these issues, but if the Democrats can't turn this around, if they can't claw back some of these voters, some of these ethnic voters, some of these blue-collar voters, and convince them that their policies are better for them than the policies being advanced by the Republicans, then this politics of anger and grievance that Donald Trump successfully ran on will continue to prevail. I mean, you look at all the things that Trump did wrong in his campaign, all the things that he did wrong for the last 4 years, all the crudeness and the insults and the lies and being impeached twice
and convicted.
A long list of all the reasons why he is completely unsuitable to be sent back to the White House. And the majority, a strong majority of American voters said, we don't care about that. We care more about immigration. We care more about transgender people, perhaps transgender girls playing on girls' volleyball teams, that they care more about some of those cultural issues. And the Democrats are going to have to do a real autopsy here to figure out what exactly that is. I don't really know what I would advise them to do, but they're going to have to figure out who those voters are and meet them where they are, rather than continue to say, well, we are progressive ideas. However much I agree with those ideas, are the better ideas, and we're going to keep running on them no matter what it does to our electoral prospects. Because we are now looking at probably a 7-2 conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court for the rest of my life and the rest of all of our lives here, maybe the rest of Austin's life. I don't know. It's a major defeat for the Democratic Party, and they need to figure out what to do.
There's going to be lots and lots of different reasons, and we're going to be talking about it and hearing about surveys and such for a long time to come. But I do think we're going to hear more that the Democrats' identity politics is going to be a big part of it. It can't be everything. There will be many other reasons.
What does that mean, Kate?
What I mean by that is that the Democrats' even though a big part of Kamala Harris's message at all her rallies would be there is more that unites us than divides us. And yet the Democrats over and over again will identify people by race, sex, and sexual orientation when they don't need to. And she didn't do a lot of that herself, but for instance, when she announced her campaign, instantly you had, I think the first group was a group of Black men who organized a big fundraising campaign just for Black men, a big Zoom call just for Black men to fundraise. And rather, you know, they didn't do that without talking to anybody. Rather than encourage inclusive and unifying fundraising, the campaign obviously encouraged more of that. So we saw many different Zoom calls. You had to be a white woman or you had to be a white man, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think that unifies people. Certainly the people who voted for Trump do not like that kind of messaging. The Democrats would do better to steer more away from that.
I think that identity politics played some role, but I think what isn't talked about enough is that Trump very much plays on identity politics. And specifically, I think that explains a lot of the movement among Latino voters is that he did play a nativist identity politics in terms of appealing to someone's identity as an American citizen against illegal immigrants. And that is a form of identity politics.
That's true.
And that has been ascendant across the globe, as we've seen. And I think ultimately there's going to be so many different autopsies of this campaign. But if I were to take away one kind of key messaging point, these incumbent parties globally have been losing. A vast majority of Americans thought the U.S. was on the wrong track. Joe Biden had a very low approval rating. So if you were a voter who was sort of non-ideological, somewhat aware of the political landscape, and you do not like Washington, D.C., and do not like politicians, this describes a very large number of Americans. The Harris campaign was not able to successfully give enough reasons for that type of person to vote for Harris. And there may not have been anything she could have done to make that argument because she is part of the incumbency. So, but if I had to pick one thing, I think that would be one messaging point I would emphasize.
I think that analysis makes sense, Austin. And I think I've said before in the show, when Trump stepped aside and Harris was whisked into his place.
Biden stepped aside. Sorry.
Biden. When Biden stepped aside in my dreams, and Harris was whisked in, I said, we'll see how good his timing was. He's either a hero or the GOAT. And I don't mean greatest of all time. I think
lowercase GOAT.
Right. I think his legacy is going to be defined by his timing. Had he stuck with his original promise, I think, to the voters that he was to be a transitional president, that one term was all that was appropriate for him, whether it was his age or just really his place in the arc of history, and we had had an open primary, we'd have had a real contest. The fact that I think the incumbency is totally the issue, that day on The View, when Harris couldn't say a single thing that she would do differently, that it was drummed into every voter in Michigan, I can tell you.
Even though her truth is different than that, it was the bad answer. It's a bad soundbite. It was a soundbite. I don't think she was a rubber stamp for Biden policies. We'll never know, but you can't imagine that she would have been, although I wouldn't have changed much about the economy. And you don't have a Wayback Machine. You can't fix a couple months of 9% inflation. When politicians say something like that, and the other side goes, we gotcha, over the course of 2 years, if you campaign enough, you're going to say something that will be used against you. It's inevitable.
She didn't have 2 years. She only had this tight window, which is part of the problem with Biden's timing. But I just think the economy, the power of that issue is hard to overstate. I think about Latina a woman who she had just bought her own home. She was on her doorstep and just said to me, she didn't think she would vote. She didn't like Trump, but she didn't think she could support Harris. Many voters said their solution was maybe to not vote. And that's why it looks like an undercount in some places. I think they just chose not to vote. But she just said every month, I'm trying to figure out how to pay my bills. And Trump, she said he wouldn't raise taxes. Instead, he's going to use something else. She couldn't remember what it was called. It was tariffs. And she did not understand that tariffs are a pass-along, pass-through mm-hmm. cost until I shared that with her. And maybe that changed her mind. It was not as conclusive as some other voters. But I understand that this idea that this economy is the envy of the world. I had fellow canvassers who wanted to say that to voters, and I urged them not to because they don't feel that way. This is a level of economic understanding. All they know is every month, like she said, she can't afford all the bills. She has to sort through them and see what she can pay. And this idea, I did say that all the things that Harris did have in her opportunity economy plan, including the help for down payment for homes, she said, I just moved into my first home. Would it help me?
Do you guys have an explanation, though, then, for how well the markets are doing today? Was that another surprise for everybody? The Dow is close to 44,000. The S&P and NASDAQ are at record highs. Doesn't impact the audience you're talking about, probably, Marge, but there that is.
Stability, at least now they're known. They know where things are going to go, and they're going to be favorable to corporations.
Right, but I don't think that I wasn't expecting if Kamala Harris had won for the Dow to go up 1,300 points. Out of the gate and keep that surprised me, no matter who the president is.
Just going back just a little bit to what you guys were saying about Kamala Harris not having time to campaign, obviously, and really get her message out there. Yes, that's true. She didn't have much time, but she did choose to have the nomination handed to her by President Biden, essentially. She chose to do that, to basically make sure nobody else would challenge her so that she would be able to enter the process without going through any kind of competition with anybody else who might have stepped up if it had been thrown open on purpose. She chose that. She also chose to go with the strategy of not talking to anybody until long after the Democratic National Convention, as we know. And then when she did finally start having the interviews, she also chose the strategy of purposely not answering the hard questions to differentiate herself from her past positions that were no longer popular, such as on immigration. Yep. Those were her choices to do. She didn't have much time, but those were her choices. I do think that the Democratic Party has a problem structurally. The last time we had a true competitive Democratic presidential primary was arguably in 2008 for Barack Obama's first one. We know that the 2016 DNC was in the bag with Hillary to make sure that Bernie Sanders did not in any way possibly get close to clinching the nomination. They did. We know that. Donna Brazile wrote about it quite eloquently. In 2020, what happened in 2020? They obviously got together and bought off all the other primary opponents to drop out and hand it to Biden instead.
Who would have been a better candidate for the Democrats under the circumstances of Joe Biden exiting late? Gavin Newsom, Gretchen Whitmer?
You know, potentially we really didn't get that kind of process as we should have. Even in 2020.
But you didn't have that much time.
Feel like the Democrats purposely short-circuited at every step instead of trusting actual democracy.
I'm saying that goes back to Biden's people then.
I really don't. Yeah. I mean, it goes back to Biden's decision to delay dropping
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Obviously.
For this year, yes, absolutely.
And so when it was mid-late July when he finally decided to drop out, the Democratic Party did not have time to run primaries. At that point, you can't gin up an entire primary process and then follow that with a successful general election campaign. There was just no way. So I don't know that Harris could, if Harris had said, no, I don't want to do this, who they would have selected. And I don't think that whoever they would have selected would have done a whole lot better. I don't see another candidate out there who, in the Democratic Party, who would have beaten Trump under these circumstances. I mean, name them. Who would it be? So, yeah, that's a problem. I think Kate's right. I think that there needs to be a nice, robust, open primary next time. I think that will help sort out some of these issues. But I don't think that just that kind of retrospection is really what the problem was here. I think Harris ran a pretty good campaign.
I do, too.
Given the situation, she excited people. She had people, friends of mine going out and canvassing for the first time. She had people, I was phone banking myself for the first time. I detected a lot of enthusiasm among Democrats and progressives for Harris that I did not detect for Biden. But it still was not enough. I don't think you can say, well, gee, if she'd only talked to Joe Rogan or if she'd only, done this or that. I don't see it. I see this as some sort of a fundamental policy and messaging issue that the Democrats are going to have to deal with. Otherwise, they're going to lose again in 4 years to J.D. Vance or whoever the Republicans put up, because that message clearly resonated with a majority of voters in this country. And the Electoral College makes it urgent for the Democrats to switch that 12 million votes back.
I just wonder what happens if they deport all of these. I mean, there's no means by which they'll do it. But suppose we lose a lot of our migrant population, the people that are doing a lot of the work that we appreciate and need to have done. I wonder what happens then. I wonder what happens if we have tariffs. This isn't something that anybody could have been persuasive about on a doorstep, Marge, but that's why I just keep pointing to the midterms, because if they get their way, there'll be a mandate to at least switch out one of the chambers.
Now, I was wondering if Marge gave the people she knocked on the door said lesson in the Smoot-Hawley Act.
You know, that didn't come up, but
that's it.
There were some other details. I mean, I literally, the woman that I was speaking of earlier who couldn't pay her bills, she said, how would you fix that? I said, do you know what gouging is? She did not. And the woman who was concerned about criminals crossing the border, I said, it's anecdotal evidence. She didn't know what that meant either. So I while we can place a lot of blame, and I put my share shoveled in here too, but we also need to think about not only changing the message, but changing the methodology of how you reach voters, how you campaign in the current environment. There's a lot of disinformation. It's hard to separate facts from truth. There's mainstream media not taking the lead. And in fact, to the extent that they were so cautious about Trump, maybe they hurt our cause. But when I get out to talk to voters, they're not even reading those mainstream media. They're not reading any newspapers. They're not seeing the New York Times online. Then what the New York Times did is irrelevant to this voter base of Trump. So we need to have a very different kind of campaign. And Trump understood what he needed was men. He needed young men, disaffected men, and he knew where to find them. And he went out there and spent hours at a time talking to them on podcasts. We didn't match that outreach to the voters we needed, starting with Latino voters. The fact that they voted against their interest in such huge numbers, Puerto Ricans, you look at the counties in Pennsylvania, Florida, New York, where Puerto Ricans are prominent. How did that happen? Polish population, Hamtramck outside of Detroit, voted overwhelmingly for Trump. Poland is going to be history if he really lets Putin do whatever he wants. How do they not know that?
Well, and the Arab population that voted for Trump, when he's going to turn Gaza into a resort
and go back to a Muslim ban.
There's absolutely no question that if you're interested in the Palestinian cause, I know that that people were saying, well, Kamala Harris is part of Genocide Joe and his bombs, but if you think that Donald Trump is going to be better for the Arab Palestinian population, you're crazy. And yet the Arabs are coming out and endorsing Trump or endorsing Jill Stein. I mean,
that was one, going back to the biggest shocks, I thought the numbers out of Dearborn, Michigan were that may have been the craziest number I saw all evening, which was that was going for Trump, then Stein, then Harris in Dearborn, Michigan, which, I mean, is just stunning. But in an environment where the electorate's number one issue is the economy and number two is immigration, I do not know how you win a national popular vote as an incumbent. I think it's really, really hard needle to thread, which is why I do understand the retrospective on was there a Democrat who could have run not as an incumbent? Maybe there could have been. Like, people talk about, okay, Shapiro as the VP. I think even if she had picked Shapiro as VP, maybe she wins Pennsylvania, but that doesn't change the outcome of the race. Does Shapiro at top of the ticket do better? Maybe. Does a Whitmer at top of the ticket do better? Maybe, especially in Michigan, given the Senate results there. But I think that incumbency disadvantage is really, really hard to shake. And what we're going to see now is, will the policy choices of Trump match that nativist rhetoric that led this very diverse plurality to vote for him? Because if those policies are implemented, John, you're correct. Prices are going to go up. It's not going to be good for jobs. It's not going to be good for the stock market. It's going to be bad for the average American consumer.
But Austin, he didn't build the wall last time, and he didn't Obamacare.
Yeah.
So I tell myself, don't be too worried about all of these horrible things that you heard about, or stupid things, because sure, they probably won't be able to get them done.
And I think what you'll probably find in these midterms, and this might be too rosy-eyed if you're Democrat, too pessimistic if you're Republican, is that Democrats can win on the economy. They can win on immigration. Democrats won a lot on immigration in the 90s. They can definitely win on abortion. If you look at a state like Florida, they didn't get to the 60% threshold, but you still had 57, 58, 59% of a deep red state voting in favor of abortion access. So these are issues that Democrats can win on. The Republican majorities are going to be quite narrow in the House and Senate. While this is a very stinging presidential loss, I think in 2 years, it's a very, very different picture when that incumbency disadvantage is not hanging over their head.
I want to read you guys a text message. Go ahead, Marge.
One more question after, because you talk about the top issues in the country, Austin, and that was true, except there was that one exit poll survey. Was it the New York Times exit poll last night? I can't remember. CNN's maybe, that said the number one issue for those who voted was actually saving democracy. It was just 2 points ahead of immigration. No, of the economy, and then immigration was third. So I thought, when I heard that, I thought, well, if they're voting for democracy, Trump has to lose. How do you explain that was a big concern, that message broke through, but then it broke for him? I'm mystified by that, though buoyed a little bit by what you just said, Austin. In 2 years, we can make that case, because he'll have presumably done his best to demolish democracy in 2 years.
In general, I try not to put too much stock in exit polling, even if it's from a reputable source. And if you, those kinds of exit polling, that kind of exit polling versus just the avalanche of like every single pollster in every single state is like, these are one, this is two, this is one, this is two. I would be surprised if that changed that drastically on election day. I haven't seen that particular poll, but I mean, if this was a referendum on democracy, if this was actually a referendum on democracy, I think you would probably see a different result.
On the other hand, though, Austin, you did see that the Republicans were campaigning on the idea that Kamala Harris is a fascist and that the end of democracy is going to be at the hands of Democrats.
Musk's closing argument was, this is going to be the last election. I think that's totally right, Eric. There was, especially in the last 2 weeks to a month, that Republicans also talked about this sort of democracy message, free speech, things like that, which is in a similar vein.
Well, we'll see what happens when Trump decides to go after the enemies from within. They include any of us on this panel, just for instance. I do think that this message that democracy is on the line was one that did cut both ways. Honestly, if you look at it, and I'll be curious to see some of the crosstabs on these exit polls to see if those who felt that democracy was on the line, how they voted, because I'm sure that it wasn't 100% or 90% or 80% for the Democrats, that there are a lot of Republicans who thought that Joe Biden and his executive overreach was a threat to democracy. I think it's absurd. I think the Democratic Party is all about democracy and free and fair elections, and you're not going to see Democrats charging the Capitol. You're not going to see Kamala Harris refusing to certify the vote. You're going to see an orderly transition of power. My guess is that Joe Biden will show up at that inauguration for Trump and shake his hand. I guess that that's the case, that there is that. But I do think that this is time for an autopsy for the Democrats. And you're right that in 2 years, generally these off-year elections tend to swing toward the party that's out of power because people are perennially dissatisfied because they want to have high incomes and low prices and low taxes and lots of services. And that's just the way it is. It's been identified as the big babies phenomenon over the years, which is that, you know, voters want an impossible values of, like I said, all those things, low taxes, but lots of services. They want small government, but they say they want small government, but they actually want big government services and so on. So we are a discontented people. I don't know when the last time was that people said that the country's on the right track under any administration. I would be curious to know when the last time that was. So you're going to have people in 4 years going, the country's on the wrong track. I'm going to vote the Republicans out. That's going to happen probably. But the presidential election in 4 years is going to be really, really critical. And the Democrats have to start thinking about that now.
They should think about whether or not they really should use that approach again of accusing the Republicans of being fascists in disguise or not even in disguise.
Even if they are fascists.
Because it's a two-edged sword. Because when you use that as your major argument, then what you're saying is that all of their supporters know it and are the kind of people who would vote for Hitler. And these are the people who you are trying to win over onto your side, and you're insulting them. So I'm just saying it's a two-edged sword. One voting thing that I noticed that was interesting, and I'm certainly interested in what you guys think of it and what it might portend, is that apparently in the exit polling this time, for the first time that they've been doing this type of exit polling, they saw that a majority of voters identified as independents rather than as Democrats or Republicans. Mm. It was, I think, a 4% increase in people going for independents, also saying that they had voted for a Republican for
Trump.
Do you
have the numbers, Kate? Like, is it 34, 30, yeah. 26 or something? How did that break out? More people identified as independent on exit polling in the election.
Yes. Independents were 34%, 34% Republicans, 32% Democrats. So they were tied with Republicans.
Yeah.
But that was a 4% differential from the past. Sorry.
Right. In 2020, 37% of voters identified as Democrats. And in 2012, 38% identified as Democrats.
People are getting away from wanting to be one or the other.
I don't think we were trying to go using the fascist language was not an attempt to draw from Trump's base those people who identified with him and his policies and the ugliness of some of what he was saying. We were trying to get those independents to choose a side. There's another data point I wanted to throw out. I heard a psychologist interviewed in a podcast recently who was doing a study that said that there's two kinds of people. There's the people who are comfortable with uncertainty and people who are uncomfortable with uncertainty. The latter group needs to be told what to do and they'll just believe it, or what the truth is and they'll just believe it. Then they crossed this with a survey about people's comfort level with cognition, thinking, and found that people who didn't like uncertainty also don't like to think about things on their own. Just tell me and I will believe you. And I think that is overcome with quality education and critical thinking skills that we don't teach. And if Trump goes ahead with Project 2025's desire to cut the education department, or at least to cut funding for public schools or universities, we're going to see a lot more or a lot less tolerance for cognition.
We have 17 minutes left in this podcast. I want to get to what happened in the city. But I got this text message from a listener today. No offense, John, but the media failed us. They kept trying to normalize Trump while holding Harris to a much higher standard. Well, congratulations, it worked.
The media environment's changed so much, and I it's so annoying to me when people say things like the media, like which media? There's so many forms of media right now. Everybody on this show is a media creator of some kind now. It's just completely distributed. So I think that's kind of not really a helpful distinction. I think it was mentioned before, but especially younger voters consume news in long form video and images more than any other generation. And that potentially was part of the reason that Trump and Vance were able to win, or at least perform better among Latino men and white men, is going on really long form shows. I hope that in general, you start to this is very silver lining, but that more candidates who run are able to excel in formats like that, hopefully will improve candidate quality, like at the margin, because having a 3-hour discussion with somebody about a wide range of issues is pretty tough to do if you don't like know at least a little something about everything that you're talking about. And I also think it's a good way for, like, it's a much more information dense experience as a voter than listening to, for example, a debate. And like that was kind of an encouraging media trend, although it ended up in some pretty horrific results federally.
But although
I hope that it continues.
But some of the stuff in those 3-hour a Joe Rogan conversation is not 3 hours of dense policy.
It completely depends. And I'm not trying to say like, okay, you listen to a 3-hour Joe Rogan interview on someone and like you learn, you know, the secrets of the universe. No, these are very base level things. I'm saying more in terms of getting to know some element of how someone thinks on their feet, some mm-hmm. element of mm-hmm. like, especially if it's totally no topic is off limits and it's an interviewer who has a pretty interesting background knowledge and can ask difficult questions. While having a respectful rapport. I just think that that's a form of media that hasn't been available in a sort of presidential political setting. I mean, hardly ever. We've only seen it at scale once, and it was this election. And I think that will change, we will continue heading toward that path in future elections.
The mincing rascals keep rolling. We'll get to a Chicago topic in a second. But first, let's go to Ottawa, Illinois. The middle of everywhere, surrounded by open spaces, rivers, and trails, Ottawa is a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy still some fall relaxation. Settle down, snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels to luxury resorts, private rentals, B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Now, back to your mincing rascals. Who is surprised by the results of the Chicago school board election? I don't think a podcast in America has talked about school board elections as much as this one has. but I think we have all along seen it as a referendum for the mayor. So it's a much larger topic than that.
I'm really interested to hear Austin's take. He texted me last night about this, and it looked to me like a split verdict that the candidates backed by the Chicago Teachers Union won 4 races, although one of them was uncontested, and that candidates that were independent of endorsements by any major interest group won 3 of the races, and then candidates backed by the Illinois Policy Institute, where Austin works, and the Illinois Network of Charter Schools won 3 of the races. Not the kind of result that a mayor in a city like this, which is a strong union town and has backed the teachers union, would have hoped for. Not a disaster, but I kind of see it as a split verdict, but I think Austin sees it another way. So I'm going to yield the floor to him.
Yeah, I see it as a total rebuke of the mayor. So if you look at over the last 20 years, there's a great political science professor at Boston College, Michael Hartney, who has done research on school board elections across the nation. And if you are in a competitive school board race and you are endorsed by the teachers union in America, you win 70% of the time. Of the 9 competitive elections in this race, in these school board races, the Chicago Teachers Union won 33% of the time. So I was texting a few political folks from previous mayoral administrations over the last 24 hours. All of them said, if this happened under any normal mayoral administration, that mayor's chief of staff would have been fired today for that result. And I think the difference is, so again, it's 9 competitive races. There's one uncontested, 3 CTU endorsed candidates won, 6 candidates who were not endorsed by CTU won. And that's, Erica is correct that of those 6, 3 of those were endorsed by Illinois Policy PAC, and 3 were not endorsed by Illinois Policy PAC. But those folks who are not CTU endorsed are more toward, are more reform minded and more independent of the union. You look at someone like Therese Boyle, who is a former teacher who won on the Southwest side. Therese Boyle was part of the Members First Caucus within the Chicago Teachers Union, which is the anti Stacey Davis Gates and Jackson Potter caucus, which is the anti Brandon Johnson caucus. It's the part of the union that says we are doing way too much radical politics. We are spending way too much money on politics. We need to spend more money on our own members and representing us in grievances. They're also more friendly to school choice generally. You look at a candidate even endorsed by CTU who won. This is counting in CTU's win column. I don't think it should. In District 1, Jennifer Custer, she was endorsed by CTU, but that was a heads-up race, one-on-one. So CTU could not go with Michelle Pierre, who is heavily backed by charters, which CTU is very much against. But Custer was very critical of CTU throughout the election, very critical of Brandon Johnson throughout the election, and CTU did not spend money on her race. So I think on WBBM last night, Craig Delamore and Mike Flannery, I think, correctly framed it as a rebuke of the mayor. Tribune similarly, Sun-Times reporting similarly. So they should have been able to sweep this, and they did not, because I think their brand is becoming toxic.
And if I understood correctly, the CTU outspent all the other, you know, charter and outside money in every race. So you throw that in there too.
Really? I didn't realize that.
I think it was seven of nine races, the CTU candidate was the top spender.
Well, I think Johnson has a difficulty understanding how to switch from activism to governing. You can be an activist mayor, but you still have this overriding responsibility to manage budgets responsibly, negotiations responsibly. I agree with you, Austin, that his over-identification with the CTU is not helping him. It doesn't seem good for the city. Although, you know, I've said before, I think the CTU does have the best interest of schools at heart. And fundamentally, if Johnson could better explain his vision for investing in people instead of sticking with just hyperbole and sloganeering to tell us about what's needed to make schools a more integrated part of the community, providing support for homeless students and providing more social services is something CPS used to do in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and gradually those wraparound services were whittled out of the budget to the detriment of our communities. I wish I could hear Johnson talk clearly about that and align himself with goals that would improve communities instead of sloganeering and arrogance, which is how he talks about his agenda. Like, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Well, we all know. And someone says, trust me, we're not gonna.
Or when he says he's got a mandate, the voters gave him a mandate to do this and that. I mean, he narrowly won that election against Paul Vallis. And he won the election, and he has the right to govern for sure. But he has to realize that when you have a narrow majority of voters behind you, and your approval ratings are in the teens, you need to do some compromising and negotiating and reaching out to the other side. So maybe he also needs to do an autopsy about this particular result and say, why didn't we do better? If you say, like, the CTU candidate in the first district, which is my district, was speaking out against the CTU and speaking out against the mayor, and they endorsed her anyway, that means they didn't go out and find a candidate that they could get behind. and put money into. And that's a failure at some level of politics to have to endorse a candidate that's bad-mouthing you.
This brings up my favorite topic in the Bears proposal, which he's handling the same way. He's in bed with the side he's supposed to be negotiating against. Mm-hmm. And when he should have gone to that press conference as an audience member, bravo, thanks for giving us this. We'll take it under advisement and get back to you. Instead, he's like, this is a done deal. It's awesome. And I'll tell you how much it'll cost you later. Mm-hmm. We don't feel like he's standing up for us in either of these cases, even though he might have a good idea, although with the Bears plan, I think he doesn't for a lot of reasons. But with the public schools, I think he knows some things about what's good for education and for communities and schools, but he doesn't give himself the independent standing, or he doesn't side with us as voters and help explain it to us. He just looks like he's already in the tank for the wrong side. You know, I support him and his progressive policies, but he's not very good at communicating or implementing them.
It's not only his words or lack of words, but really his actions in the schools and the timing of those coming ahead of these elections. And that's why I focus on the record of CTU endorsed versus not CTU endorsed candidates, because I think this was a referendum on should they be on both sides of the negotiating table or not. We've seen the actions that happen when they are was the entire school board being ousted for refusing to issue this high interest loan and refusing to fire Pedro Martinez. And then, I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, but then the new president being appointed, posting that 9/11 was an inside job, posting just anti-Semitic bile, misogynist bile, no vetting clearly done whatsoever. The vetting was clearly thumbs up or thumbs down. Do you support what CTU and Brandon Johnson want or not? I mean, I don't know how people could, even folks in support of broadly a CTU agenda, could support a political operation and governance that functions that way, because it's clearly like just chaos in schools right now because of that.
Austin's talking about the new president of the school board who was there for 7 days, and then a Google search by somebody determined that his social media footprint had all of these terrible things like women shouldn't take jobs because those are for men, and if a woman has a job, then a guy doesn't, and that's a bad thing. Some of the things he was just liking or giving a thumbs up to, some of the things he was saying, but I don't think that's a distinction with much of a difference. If you're going to retweet something or like something, then you support that statement, even if you didn't say it first. And I don't know how they missed that stuff. I know that.
We're
so really, so the takeaway to me isn't all the terrible things this guy said, but rather just how administratively inept the administration is. How could you not see that coming?
And just to emphasize that, these are not, 20 years ago writings on the bathroom stall. This is, someone on last Tuesday night called me at 10:30 at night saying, you need it. Someone just told me the school board president posted XYZ. I searched the guy's name on Facebook, went like this with my thumb. I'm doing a scrolling motion for approximately 4 minutes before you see 9/11 was an inside job with the caption facts, exclamation.
That was him, yeah.
Same thing with this. Like, you wouldn't... Just a job at a Portillo's or something, like would have a background check would have found this, much less the president of the fourth largest school district in the country. I mean, that I will never. There's so many things like this that happen with this administration that I forget them. This is one where it's just so absurd that I feel like we're going to forget about it in 2 months.
Just to be clear, you're saying 9/11 was not an inside job. Is that right, Austin? I just wanted
for clarity, it is not facts, !! that 9/11 was an inside job.
Would you hire that person to work at Portillo's, Austin? If somebody said it was an inside job, would you let them wear the microphone and the headset out front and take your order?
That's a really good question. I don't think I would hire them at my location. Do I think there should be a categorical ban on crazy people from working at entry-level jobs? I don't. That might be Pandora's box.
In which I was phrasing that question. Yeah. I'd hire them.
And this is an example of how rushed this decision was to secure the resignations of all seven members of the school board, and then to appoint six, I guess, new members right the following Monday. I mean, it was rushed, and Johnson refused to answer questions about who was vetted, and he indicated the vetting was going to take place after the appointment. It was just done poorly, and yet another example of how I don't think he's ready to be mayor.
Well, I wonder if there's an umbrella question you ask where you just say, "Hey, listen, we're in a hurry here. We're going to do the best we can, but have you ever said any crazy on the platforms out there? Because we need to know that. Help us at least anticipate it. Could you just tell us if you've said 9/11? For instance, 9/11 was an inside job. That's one of the mothers of them all. Did you say that?
Go say ahead. Anything about childless cat ladies?
Yeah, I know.
When I was hired by the city, you did have to fill out a form, and there was a question at that time, a couple decades ago, that said, are there any other potential negatives that we should know about, positions you've taken or jobs you've held, or statements you've made publicly? There was pre-internet, but they did ask, and by the way, anything else we should know? And if you don't disclose, that's grounds under non-protected position anyway. That's grounds for dismissal, because you were supposed to disclose it.
If I could just change the subject completely, I heard you talking on the radio yesterday to people whose spouses are on the opposite side of the political divide, and it was incredibly sad to hear wives and husbands who are losing their marriages, losing their kids, and it just really stuck with me. Yeah. And of course, after today's events, after last night's events, I can see potential cracks in various friends and family of my own. And I would just urge everybody to take a deep breath and go to Thanksgiving without talking politics, whether you're happy or sad about it, and just to have some grace for the other side, no matter which side you're on, because that's what the country really needs, and that's what will help us go forward.
That's a nice message, and I'm glad you listened to that. Maybe we'll bring it up again on this podcast. It was one of the most startling sets of conversations we've had on my radio station in years. I was shocked at what I was hearing, and this sounds apocryphal, but one of our listeners said that there was in one of the houses in their neighborhood a Trump sign and a Harris sign, and then after a while, there was a for sale sign. And I almost believe that. And now we're out of time. A shorter podcast this week. We got to give up the studio. Eric Zorn, Kate Plies, Marge Halperin, Austin Berg. Nice to see you all, hear you all, read you when you're in print. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right,
thanks. That was good. I really enjoyed that.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Take care.
I know what will really sound apocryphal, which is that I'm very friendly with the janitor in the mid-rise building right behind me. So when I come in the alley from walking the dog, I run into him taking out the garbage almost every morning. And today was no exception. And I know he is very much of Croatian immigrant stock. Very, very recent. And I said to him, so what do you think about the election?
Ooh,
and at first he was like, but then he was like, you know, this is, and he's throwing garbage away as he tells me this, you know, this is the greatest, I don't like to talk politics. I hate politics, but this is the greatest country in the world. And, you know, I just get up and I do my job. And that's what's so great about this country, that I can do that. And, you know, look, Biden got elected in 2020, and people just have to accept it and go forward, and it's fine. I'd like to be a millionaire, but I'm not. Throw another garbage bag in the dumpster, and it's fine. It's the greatest country in the world. And I was like, yes, you sound just like my grandparents. I love that.
Croatia being the place where sports fans in the soccer stands wear Confederate shirts. And they sell flags in the soccer team store with swastikas on them.
Hey, don't yuck or yum. She's just trying to tell
there
a nice story about an immigrant.
Soccer fan teams with soccer fans who are maybe not so great. But you know what? When you, these people do come from, you know, previously very authoritative dictatorship, communist dictatorships, and they do tend to see the world differently than the
glass is half full.
Give John his studio back.
I'm out of the studio.
Okay.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.